As we continue worshiping together this morning, I invite you to rise as you are able as we receive these words from the Gospel according to Luke, the 7th chapter, beginning with the 36th verse. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And a woman in the city who was a sinner, having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. She stood behind him at his feet, weeping, and began to bathe his feet with her tears and to dry them with her hair. Then she continued kissing his feet and anointing them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw it, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what kind of woman this is, who is touching him, that she is a sinner." Jesus spoke up and said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." "Teacher," he replied, "speak." A certain creditor had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt for both of them. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon answered, "I suppose the one for whom he canceled the greater debt." And Jesus said to him, "You have judged rightly." Then turning towards the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has bathed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which were many, have been forgiven. Hence, she has shown great love, but the one to whom little is forgiven loves little." Then he said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." But those who were at the table with him began to say amongst themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Hear what the Spirit is saying. At this time, we invite our children in the kindergarten.
He sought out to find his lost family and does so. The Martian, starring Matt Damon and Jessica Chastain. Matt plays an astronaut who becomes stranded on Mars after his team assumed he was dead. They later found out that he was still alive, and they put together a plan to bring him back home. The Trip to Bountiful, which starred the late Geraldine Page as a woman who wants to return to her home during the post-World War II 1940s. When she gets there, she finds that the town is deserted. She is moved to tears as she surveys her father's land and the remains of the family home. Accepting this reality, she goes back, knowing that she had gone home one last time. And we all know our favorite canine, Lassie. Remember the movie Lassie Come Home? Starring Riley McDowell and Elizabeth Taylor and our canine actor, Pal. The movie is set in Depression-era Yorkshire, England. Lassie's owners are poor, so they sell their dog to a rich duke. His granddaughter knows that the dog is unhappy, so arranges for the dog to escape. So Lassie sets off to go home and escapes many dangers before returning to her home. 12 years a slave. Chiwetel Ejiofor plays Solomon Northrup, a free African-American man who in 1841 is kidnapped in Saratoga Springs, New York, and enslaved again. After some intervention by key people, he is restored to freedom and returns to his family after 12 years. As he walks into his home, he sees his wife and their son and daughter, now fully grown. He sees his son-in-law, who presents him with his grandson. He apologizes for his long absence while his family comforts him after coming back home. Lastly, rabbit-proof fence. An Australian film set in 1931 about three mixed-race Aboriginal young girls who are kidnapped and placed in a camp where they are to be trained to be servants in white families. The three girls escape. One is recaptured again, but the other two follow a rabbit-proof fence and walk 1,500 miles in 9 weeks to go back home. So something about coming home that has a special appeal. I'm going to share some personal stories that you may feel for yourself. I recall being in England as a grad student, and I was there with fellow students, and we had a good time over in England. As we were heading back home, we got on the plane, and you could hear a pin drop. I'm sure the others, like me, were feeling a great deal of remorse because we recalled all the times we spent together in London, getting there and getting lost on the tube, going to Piccadilly Circus, going to see Janis Joplin at Royal Albert Hall. Yes, Janis Joplin, indeed. Going to Speaker's Corner to hear the people protest. So all of these great memories. Going to see the changing of the guards. All special things that united and caused us to be even closer. But about 6-7 hours later, as we looked out the window and saw the Statue of Liberty, we all started to smile and celebrate. We were coming back home. In the black church, we have a tradition called homecoming. And we have activities throughout the whole week culminating in a special service and a fellowship on Sunday. On many college campuses, there's something called homecoming that includes things like Yard Fest, where we have all kinds of vendors that sell food and arts and so forth. There's also some type of football game, all part of tradition about coming home. You may think of other experiences in your own that touch you very deeply about coming home. Shandalaus Parks writes in Big Questions Worthy Dreams that it has been said that home is the most powerful word in the English language. Is where we start from, is what we aspire to. To be at home is to have a place where we are comfortable, a place where we know that we belong, a place where we can be who we are, and we can honor, protect, and create what we truly love. To be home, as you know, is to be part of a rhythm of life, where we engage in patterns of leisure and play and work and engage in those special relationships that give us meaning. Diana Butler Bass, in her work Grounded, writes that home happens in numerous geographies and in a number of different dwellings. Home is more than a house. It is a sacred location, a place of aspiration and dreams, of learning and habit, of relationships and heart. A lot of us are out of place. We tend to be very transient, and we folks make our homes in all kinds of different places. In 2011, when I accepted a position to go and work in New York for Global Ministries, I recall that day when my father dropped me off in my apartment and took my car with him. I wasn't going to take my car to New York. It wasn't practical. So I sat in an empty apartment, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. After 5 years in New York, Global Ministries moved its headquarters to Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm getting ready to move again. The day before, the movers came and moved everything. So that day before I got on the plane to go to Atlanta, I sat in an empty apartment and cried and cried and I cried. After being in New York for 2 years, I was advised that my appointment to the Global Ministries was coming to an end. So I was about to move again. So, the day before, movers came and took all of my furniture. So again, I sat in an empty apartment in Atlanta and did what? Cried and I cried and I cried. Because I had established such rich relationships in Buffett and all those places, friendships and loyalties, felt affirmed and felt part of community. And that's all part of being home. Although I was transient, these places still represented home for me. Now, in her work, Diana Butler Bass also reminds us that home can be a place of horror as well. Too many people have experiences of home that shelters sickness and addiction, of homes that deteriorate from carelessness and neglect, or homes broken apart through willful violations of relationships in them, resulting in reports of domestic violence. I would also add, unfortunately, reports of incest. Indeed, some social scientists refer to home-centered violence as intimate terrorism. Then there are those who have no home. The things we take for granted, even in our very midst, even this community there, the homeless people. I've come to work here at the Trace often and come to the side door where someone is actually sleeping at the entrance. We exchange pleasantries as I enter the church. There are those young adults and children who identify themselves as LGBT who actually are kicked out of their homes because they love someone other than the opposite sex. Then there are those who are part of this global migration crisis. A recent report from the Journal of Board of Trade Society shared that an estimated 65.3 million people are displaced from their homes because of conflict and persecution. Tens of thousands of unaccompanied children are annually apprehended at U.S. borders. They're refugees. And the Church World Service report that the wait in a refugee camp can be as long as 10 years. Even before they begin the process of being resettled, they stay in these camps for at least 10 years or more. And the whole vetting process with fingerprint taking and interviews can take up to 2 years. Only the most vulnerable are referred, accounting for less than 1% of refugees worldwide being resettled. Now, let's take a closer look at this Lucan passage that was read this morning. And I'm not going to speak of the obvious theme about sin and debts being forgiven and so on. Instead, I'm going to approach this by looking at three main characters and how they interact with each other. That will give us some clues about the text and the theme. Let's look at Simon the Pharisee first. As a reminder, a Pharisee is a member of the group of Jewish people who followed a strict code of religious laws. They played a role of Jesus' opponents, practicing a lifestyle of separation from unbelievers or Jews outside of their own group. The word Pharisee means separated. They considered themselves more holy and righteous than ordinary men. So why did the Pharisee invite Jesus to his house for dinner? He was probably thinking, who is this guy? This Jesus guy who's been causing so much fuss. I want to kind of get a closer look at this young man and see what he's all about. So his attitude towards Jesus is very ambivalent. He addresses Jesus as teacher, but yet did not show the traditional hospitality. Why not? Probably because he was spending most of his time playing host to his other guests he was trying to impress. He was giving Jesus an assessment, trying to determine his credentials, so to speak. Who is this guy in the first place? So the Pharisee, this character, with his arrogance, represents those who look down on others with disdain. As I was reflecting on his character and how he reacted to certain people in the text, I thought about this scene from the movie Philadelphia, about Tom Hanks, who plays a lawyer who gets fired from his job because he has AIDS. And the scene that I'm referring to shows Tom Hanks' character in the library doing some research to build his defense. A librarian comes over to him and says, "Wouldn't you rather go someplace else?" And Tom Hanks says, "No, I'm staying right here." And so the librarian just stood over him, looking at him with such disdain and distaste that it made the character uncomfortable. That's how I see the Pharisees in this world, looking down at others. Then there's the woman, who is simply referred to as a sinner. Elizabeth Schuessler Fiorenza, in an essay that's taken from a memory of her, points out that the story does not say what kind of sinner the woman was. A sinner could be a criminal, a ritually unclean or morally bad person, a prostitute, or simply the wife of a notorious sinner. But look at her actions. She enters the scene uninvited, ignoring the boundaries of class and patriarchy. She just comes into the scene. She knew that Jesus was there. She washes Jesus' feet and dries them with her hair. And during those times, touching or caressing a man's feet could have sexual implications, as did letting down one's hair in public. She made quite a scene, didn't she? So you can imagine how Simon the Pharisee felt about all this. He was insulted. And lastly, let's look at what Jesus does. He challenged us to confront the Pharisees in our own society. When he talks to Simon the Pharisee, he exposes Simon's lack of hospitality. He says, "Hey, you did not greet me with a kiss when I came into your home. You did not offer me water to wash my feet when I came in, nor did you offer to put oil on my head." And this is significant because in the Middle East, the importance of honor and shame is very high. As I reflect on Jesus' actions, I would like to suggest that Jesus presents a model for how we should confront people and structures that prevent everyone from being excluded, from being felt wanted, from being affirmed, and protected. We consider those structures. We say no to immigration policies that prevent us from welcoming our neighbors. We say no to book of discipline that would deny someone like T.C. Morrow to be ordained as a clergy person in our church. We say no to institutions that tolerate the abuse of the elderly, the mentally challenged, or other vulnerable people. We say no to the racism in our penal system, causing a disproportional number of black and brown persons in mass incarceration. We say no to sexism in corporate America and in our churches. We say no to white supremacists participating in rallies like those that are going to happen next week. We say no to racial profiling. And Pastor Ben, we say no to schools that pass kids through who cannot read or write. As I approach my conclusion, let's look again at the importance of this scene being one of a dinner. I frame this again around the work of Diana Butler Bass, who writes about John Wesley's emphasis on holy habits and declares, "Home is a training ground for spiritual and ethical habits that we take out into the world, with a door and table being the school for holy habits. It is around tables where we learn what to eat and how, ways to set a table for special guests, how to share customs and traditions, and how to serve others. The table is the earthly manifestation of God's presence, the heavenly feast where all are fed and sustained, and no one suffers from a lack of anything." This closely aligns with the Pacific Islanders' practices of reciprocity and mutuality. Simone, Lisa, I know about this. Times of fellowship and meals are inherently spiritual as they promote the body's growth by making the mundane sacred. Meals are never just a time of eating. It's always a time of sharing the journey. Meals are times of celebration and feasting. And the abundant display of food in their culture affirms the bountiful providence of God, a celebration of what God is doing in the midst of scarcity. So that's one of the practices that I really appreciate. So as I reflect on this text, I marvel at how Jesus, by assuming the role as host, transforms a mundane feast at the Pharisees' home to a sacred place, a sacramental place where all are welcome. Our departed servant, Larry Stuckey, writes in Eucharist that Jesus' fellowship is a manifestation of a new creation which embraces all who are discriminated against in the course of human activity. To this feast, all are invited by God on equal terms. No one approaches the feast by means of merit, but all are invited by grace. There, at this feast, at this table, no one can boast or dominate or exclude, for this is Christ's feast. Maya Angelou writes that the egg for home lives in all of us, the safe place where we can go as we are and not be questioned. So, Founding United Methodist Church, as I come home again to my annual conference, I will partner with you to help us welcome anyone who wants to join our family and have this church be their home. Regardless of one's sexual orientation, regardless of one's ethnicity, color, whether you're white collar, blue collar, whether you can form a perfect sentence or not, all are welcome. So, I want to partner with you as we live up to who we claim to be. Amen.